The Spirit and the Stick, Chapter 11, The Greatest Ever. Give a boy a stick he can hold, give a boy a ball he can toss, and you've given him something that's better than gold, the pleasure of playing lacrosse. Attributed to Douglas C. Turnbull, Jr. Lewis met the Jones family for lunch at the Mount Washington Tavern in Baltimore. He had previously arranged for a special guest to meet them there. At exactly 12 o'clock, Lewis led Robbie to an older gentleman and introduced him. "Stuart, this is Robbie Jones." "Hi, Robbie, I'm Stuart McLean. It's a pleasure to meet you." Robbie's eyes lit up, as did his parents. "John, Catherine, Mary, this is Stuart McLean, Naval Academy Class of 48, the first recipient of the Turnbull Award." "It's quite an honor to meet you, Mr. McLean," offered John Jones. "Stuart, please. And a pleasure is mine." "I suppose Jim has shared with you the nature of our relationship," said Mary. "He has, and it sounds like a truly remarkable one at that. I wasn't aware that Doug and Jack had passed down a stick to Jim and then to your son." "I thought it would be fun to meet Stuart since he actually knew Jack and Doug and saw both of them play. Would you mind sharing a little bit of your relationship with the Turnbull brothers, with Robbie and Catherine?" Lewis asked. "Not at all. Well, it's been quite a while since anyone has asked me about those two men. They were truly special, as were their parents and sisters. I grew up not far from here in the Mount Washington part of town. I played lacrosse at St. Paul's School. After playing for Hopkins, both Doug and Jack played for the Mount Washington Club. For many years, decades really, Mount Washington was the best team in the country. We idolized those guys. I was lucky because their field was only a 5-minute walk from my house and a 10-minute walk from school. I got to see both of them play quite a bit. By then, Doug was playing mostly defense. Jack played everywhere. He faced off and played attack. He was tenacious but fair in everything he did. They were fun to watch. They were always gentlemen on and off the field. We would talk to them after games, and they always took time to throw around with us. Doug was the only 4-time first-team All-America for 50 years. A player named Frank Urso from Maryland earned his 4th award in 1975. I remember reading that Doug presented his certificate to him. He was genuinely happy for the young man. Then another player from Hopkins, Del Dressel, accomplished it again in the mid-80s. Doug worked for many years as an executive at the B&O Railroad here in Baltimore. He was always active in the game. Lewis picked up the story. "Mr. Turnbull was inducted into the National Lacrosse Hall of Fame in 1962, the year I graduated from high school. Many people considered Doug to be the greatest player ever. If you ask him, though, he would be the first to tell you that Jack far surpassed his abilities. The only reason Jack wasn't also a 4-time first-team All-America was that he graduated in 3 years. So did Doug, by the way, but he kept playing while he worked on graduate studies. Had Jack used his 4th year, he certainly would have equaled Doug's accomplishment." Lewis continued, "He often told me he had used the stick religiously, throwing against his family's barn, working his skills and then working them some more. He decided to share the stick with his younger brother Jack. Actually, as a precocious 4-year-old, Jack had already helped himself to the stick. Doug didn't fight it because the stick created a special bond between the brothers. I was extremely fortunate to have had a 45-year correspondence, maybe 2 or 3 letters per year, with Mr. Turnbull that has made me who I am today. Well, 2 or 3 letters per year for 45 years has turned into about 120 letters from him. Mr. Turnbull also sent me a book every year on my birthday. My parents were always grateful that he thought so well of me that he encouraged me to read. They were great books, too. The amazing thing is that he sent me a book every year until he died, not just when I was a kid or in school. So I have accumulated quite a library, more than 40 books. Actually, it's more like 90 because he sent me a set called the Harvard Classics, which includes about 50 volumes on my graduation from college. Each book was specially selected by him, and he always inscribed a thoughtful and personal comment and an inspirational quotation in each. It's quite a collection of letters and books, which meant a lot to me at the time, but obviously means even more to me the older I get. I learned a lot about the game of lacrosse, what its true spirit was and is. Mr. Turnbull was able to offer me advice about things in my life every step of the way. His role in my life has been incredible, and he has very much made me who I am today. He was a truly great man. McLean took his cue to continue. Robbie, did you know that Jack was a member of the United States Olympic team?
No, sir, Robbie responded. Then he suddenly connected the figure of the Olympic rings.
Did he do the carvings of the rings on the stick? He asked of Lewis.
Yes, Robbie, he did. But I should add that he participated in two Olympic Games. One in lacrosse in 1932 when he captained the team that won the gold medal. He was also a member of the 1936 U.S. men's field hockey team, which competed in Berlin, ironically, in front of Hitler. Everyone's eyes lit up.
Robbie, I think if you look carefully at the carving on the stick, you'll see that there are actually two sets of rings, one superimposed upon the other, Lewis offered. Jack carved one set after each Olympiad. Robbie mentally confirmed the fact.
Yes, I thought it looked like two sets.
McLean continued. Robbie, if you have half as much fun as Jim and I had playing lacrosse, you'll be one lucky young man. I think Jim would agree that lacrosse has added something special to our lives. It has provided us with lifelong bonds with our teammates and coaches, and in many cases with some of our opponents as well. It's a truly special game. Lewis nodded. After lunch, Lewis drove Robbie and his family to 2111 Soulgrave Avenue in the Mount Washington part of town and identified it as the Turnbull home. Robbie gazed in awe as Lewis stopped to extend their look. They continued on. McLean met the family at the Lacrosse Museum and National Hall of Fame adjacent to the Johns Hopkins University's Homewood Field. Lewis walked the family to the field and gave them some sense of the history of Johns Hopkins lacrosse and his experience playing on the field. This is one of the most historic fields in the game of lacrosse. Many people liken it to Yankee Stadium. Johns Hopkins has won some 42 national championships in lacrosse. Playing at Navy Marine Corps Memorial Stadium was always a thrill, but it was also an extraordinary privilege to play here. I'll never forget the game I played here in 1965 when we beat Hopkins in front of their homecoming crowd of over 7,000. It was particularly special for me due to my relationship with Mr. Turnbull. They walked back to the museum. Lewis paused before the magnificent life-size bronze sculpture gracing the front entrance. Stretching their sticks for a ball, two Indians are frozen for all time. Robbie stared at the statue, poring over the detail. He noticed the players wearing only breech clouts, moccasins, and war paint on their arms, legs, torsos, and faces. One of the players, the one with the ball in his stick, was jumping. Robbie wondered if the fact that one native had a left-handed stick and the other had a right-handed stick was a coincidence. Probably not. He thought of Red Hawk playing the game in this fashion. The boy read the inscription on the dedication plaque.
Creator's Game. The game of lacrosse was given by the Creator to the Iroquois and other Native American people many ages ago. It is from the Iroquois that the modern game of lacrosse most directly descends. May this sculpture forever honor the Iroquois and the origins of lacrosse. Donated by Emil A. Buzzy Budnitz, Jr., Lacrosse Hall of Fame, Class of 1976, June 4, 1992. Robbie's eyes lit up the instant he walked through the doors of the museum. Lewis allowed the family to soak in the sights and sounds at their own pace. Robbie and his sister were particularly fascinated by the display case holding a variety of ancient sticks, all in different shapes and sizes, representing different tribes. They also saw the magnificent 3-foot-high Turnbull trophy housed in its own case. Robbie craned his head to locate the names of Lewis and McLean. His heart jumped when he was able to get the right angle to read Lewis's. When the parents saw Robbie fixated on the trophy, they came up behind and realized the significance of his gaze. Lewis offered, "Stuart is too modest to point this out, but that's his name inscribed on the top." McLean proudly led the group to the Hall of Fame room, pausing at the entrance to point out the plaque dedicated to his Navy coach, William H. Moore. The Lacrosse Hall of Fame room pays tribute to Dinny Moore, who served as the first president of the Lacrosse Hall of Fame Foundation, 1960-67, for his ongoing contribution to the preservation and promotion of the sport. This room serves as a legacy to his leadership and vision. McLean then pointed out the plaques of Moore and his high school coach, Howdy Myers, among the greats enshrined.
I was extremely fortunate to have such great coaches, Robbie.
Oh, and let's not forget Captain Lewis, McLean concluded as he gestured toward the 1981 inductees.
John and Mary Jones were as enthralled with the museum as their children. Lewis and McLean patiently answered their questions that arose during the next 2 hours.
Chapter 12. Uncle Tom's Cabin. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. From Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. Upon falling asleep on the night of the next full moon, Robbie was visited by Red Hawk.
Hi, Robbie.
Hi.
Well, have you had any thoughts since we spoke last time? Is there anything you want to see now?
Would it be possible to learn anything about Mr. Turnbull's relationship with the previous custodian?
Sure, let's take a look.
Red Hawk took Robbie for another trip through time. This is Gettysburg National Military Park in May 1913. The man you see there, Red Hawk pointed, is General Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, who led the 20th Maine in a historic Civil War battle here in 1863.
Red Hawk quietly narrated the solemn scene as Robbie watched the old man, who sat on a large rock that held a granite monument just off the trail at the bottom of Little Round Top. Robbie immediately identified the figure on the monument next to Chamberlain as the one on the shaft of the stick. He broke his silence, asking Red Hawk in an excited whisper, "Is that the same cross that's on the stick?"
"Yes, it is, Robbie. It's called the Maltese Cross. It's the symbol used to represent the Union troops."
Chamberlain carved it into the shaft on his visit here on the 25th anniversary of the battle. I watched him do it. It took him most of the day to get it how he wanted it.
Another part of the puzzle solved, Robbie mused. They continued to watch.
Chamberlain sat lost in thought, whispering quietly to himself with a canteen lying by his side, and holding the stickball stick gently in his now feeble hands. He had performed the same ritual many times before. The general had just completed an extensive walk of the sacred grounds of the battlefield, pondering the momentous battle that took place between the Army of Northern Virginia and the Army of the Potomac on July 2, 1863. He had visited the cemetery where, 4 months after the battle, President Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address. He had also just visited the famous stone wall where the desperate Pickett's charge ultimately withered, inches short of a possible Confederate victory, a victory that might well have earned the South secession in the war between the states. Chamberlain had finally arrived here at the foot of Little Round Top, the true purpose of his trip. Robbie and Red Hawk stood within hearing distance of the general and listened as he spoke to himself. Chamberlain closed his eyes and replayed in his mind the heroics of his men, the 20th Maine Infantry Regiment, reliving the tremendous horror and ultimate triumph of that pivotal day nearly 50 years before. He thought of the men who had given their lives for a greater good, the unification of their country. Chamberlain's memory at age 83 recalled the events with all of the sights, sounds, smells, and emotions as fresh as if it were yesterday. The general fought back tears as he recalled the names and faces of every Maine man he had lost on that fateful day. As he conducted his heartbreaking roll call, he reminded himself of how fortunate he had been to lead those brave souls. He sat, in his earlier years he had knelt, for some 90 minutes, individually honoring each man with a personal eulogy. It was the least he could do, he pined. They deserved so much more. Red Hawk turned to his left, looking a few hundred yards toward the top of the narrow path, and briefed Robbie on the scene unfolding in that sector. Doug Turnbull Sr. and his 10-year-old son, Doug Jr., had arrived at Gettysburg that spring day at about 10 a.m. The elder Turnbull was a well-read Civil War buff, and the boy, like so many of his age, was greatly intrigued by all things military. So the father and son had set off that morning from their home just north of Baltimore for a 45-mile day trip to the battlefield.
That morning, the senior Turnbull had observed Chamberlain making his rounds of the park. He told his son that the man looked like General Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, the hero of Little Round Top. He had seen pictures of Chamberlain in newspapers and magazines. Doug Sr. chose to honor the privacy of the general and simply walked the grounds with his son, admonishing the boy that they should keep their distance and allow the gentleman to have his time. The father shared some pertinent biographical information on the general with his son. He noted that during the war, the general had been shot 6 times. The boy was overwhelmed by the presence of the general and begged his father to talk to him. Finally, the general rose from his pew among the rocks and boulders at the flank of Little Round Top. The Turnbull father and son stood nearly 100 yards away, allowing the general all the privacy they felt he needed. The senior Turnbull was particularly sensitive to what Chamberlain must have been feeling that day. As they observed the general from afar, Turnbull pondered the gloomy notion that Chamberlain might be suffering from the all-too-common melancholy that befell so many other men and women as they approached major anniversaries in their lives. He knew that Chamberlain was 3 months short of the 50th anniversary of the battle. Turnbull couldn't help but consider the uncanny coincidence that called Thomas Jefferson and John Adams to their eternal rest 50 years to the day after they signed the Declaration of Independence. He thought of the countless others who had suffered a similar fate, family members who had died on or near such anniversary dates of their spouses, siblings, parents, and children. He knew Chamberlain must have been vulnerable to such melancholy feelings at this point. Turnbull hoped his fears were unfounded, but he had lived too long and seen too many such occurrences. He feared for the general. To the astonishment and joy of the Turnbulls, Chamberlain began to walk slowly toward them. The visitors from Baltimore made eye contact with the hero, and the general said softly, "Good afternoon, gentlemen. What a great day for a walk." "Yes, sir," Doug Sr. replied. "I am Lawrence Chamberlain," the general offered in a remarkably unassuming manner. Then with a little more voice, "And who do I have the honor of meeting this fine afternoon?" He looked directly at Doug Jr. "Douglas Turnbull, Sr. and Jr., General, and the honor is ours," replied the Sr. Turnbull. Chamberlain caught the title General in the father's introduction, though he had carefully not offered that information. The father had obviously read at some length and depth on the Civil War, Chamberlain thought to himself, for he knew that he was surely not a household name or face anywhere outside of Maine, if even there. "And what brings you fine gentlemen here today?" the general asked. "Just taking the boy on a trip to experience some history, sir." "Are you an historian, my good man?" "No, sir, but I've been greatly intrigued by the Civil War for as long as I can remember. My grandfather fought in this battle as a part of the 44th New York Infantry. He survived the war but died suddenly shortly after my father was born in 1873. My father and the rest of his family have very little firsthand knowledge of the Civil War. They were far too busy just meeting their daily needs back then to think much about preserving or studying anything my grandfather had kept from the period. So I've tried to follow up on his service some. My boy is quite taken with it as well." Turnbull's remark about his grandfather immediately stirred in Chamberlain the feeling that through the brotherhood of arms he was kin to these strangers. "God bless your grandfather," Chamberlain proclaimed. "Was he a soldier or an officer?" Conventional wisdom would have placed higher esteem in being able to respond, "officer." But Turnbull had read enough to know how Chamberlain felt about his soldiers, and he proudly replied, "Soldier, sir, an infantryman who advanced to sergeant by the end of the war." "Magnificent. Ah, the soldiers. What great men. They never get near the credit they deserve. My compliments to your grandfather, my boy," Chamberlain beamed as he addressed the elder Turnbull. "When we saw you this morning, sir, it struck me that you were perhaps General Chamberlain from the 20th Maine. Is that correct?" Turnbull posed, 100% sure that it was, else he would not dare be so bold. "I am that man, sir. May I ask how you would know?" "As I said, I've tried to study the war some, and I've seen your essays and articles, as well as pictures of you in magazines and newspapers." Young Doug, who had been standing close by his father as still as a post, staring at the great hero, finally stirred. "Is that a lacrosse stick you're holding, sir?" the boy asked timidly. "Well, I believe it is, young man. The man who gave me this stick called its game stickball from the Cherokee, but I've heard the game referred to as lacrosse. Are you familiar with the game?"
Yes, sir, I have a stick of my own at home.
Well, then there's a good chance you know a lot more about the game than I do. A Confederate officer gave this stick to me very near to where we are right now. The Turnbulls presented inquisitive looks, so Chamberlain continued. It's quite a long story with which I will not burden you, but the officer was wounded and I saw to him. Later at the field hospital, he presented me with the stick. It was a noble gesture that I thought myself unworthy at the time, nor am I sure that I am worthy today. I carry it with me every time I come here. It helps me regain the vision of that day. The father asked about the upcoming 50th anniversary reunion. Chamberlain shared that the objective of his present trip was to represent his state of Maine at the conference to plan the reunion. Most of the officials were to arrive the next day, he explained. He had arrived early to enjoy peace on the field alone. Tomorrow would be far too hectic. For the next hour or so, the general was most gracious, fielding and asking questions of the man and boy. I plan to be here for the big event on July 1, Chamberlain announced. I would very much like to meet you here at that time, but I fear that there will be as many as 50,000 veterans camped all around. I would not recommend this event for the public. It will be a solemn occasion for the veterans and of little use to the general population. Oh, I'm sure there'll be many others here for it, including the newspapers, but it really is for the soldiers. However, if you'd like to attend, I'll be sure to have some time with you. I'll allow you to decide. I make a trip here most years, or at least I did until my wife passed away in 1905, the 18th of October to be exact. Since then, this is my first return. Before that, we visited every year or two. Perhaps I could meet you here again next summer, and in the meantime, if you wish, we can continue our acquaintance through the mail. Here is my address. If you will forgive me, my good men, I should be leaving for my lodging now. These old legs aren't what they used to be. The father and son excused the general and stood spellbound as Chamberlain slowly departed. Red Hawk then conveyed to Robbie the nature of the correspondence between the Turnbulls and the general over the next several months. The first letter was to Chamberlain from the elder Turnbull, thanking him for his graciousness and informing him of his incredible impact upon the boy, Red Hawk explained. A few weeks later, Chamberlain sent a telegram to the family, announcing his regret that his ill health would prevent him from attending the 50th anniversary celebration after all. This news caused the senior Turnbull to rekindle his grave concerns for the general's health. Chamberlain's old wound from Petersburg finally betrayed him in the fall of 1913, causing him to be bedridden for most of the winter. He passed away on the morning of February 24, 1914. Doug Turnbull Sr. read of the general's death in the Washington Post the following day and broke the sad news to the boy. Fortunately, since the telegram of the previous summer, the father had been preparing the boy. He knew that several historians believe that Chamberlain was the only soldier still suffering from his war wounds. 50 years later, all of the others had succumbed. He had beaten the odds, Turnbull reasoned, and the infinite satisfaction of having survived the 50 years made Chamberlain particularly vulnerable. Turnbull had begun to prepare the boy. Red Hawk then took Robbie to the Turnbull home in Baltimore on the morning of February 28, 1914. Just as Robbie and Red Hawk arrived at their station, a package arrived at the door addressed to the elder Turnbull. The return address was J.L. Chamberlain, Brunswick, Maine. The father was quite alarmed to see such a return address and quickly opened the letter on the outside of the box. It read, February 12, 1914. Dear Mr. Turnbull, I have asked my daughter Daisy to prepare this letter and box for shipment upon the arrival of my imminent death. It is a gift from me to your fine son. I would ask you to speak with him before he opens the box, with the hope that you might be able to explain the nature of death to him. With warmest regards and thanks, J.L. Chamberlain. The elder Turnbull obliged Chamberlain's request by speaking to the boy about the death of the general and sharing his views on life, death, and heaven. He then handed the boy the box. The boy opened the box and found inside it a letter from the general, an old leather bag containing the stick he had carried with him at Gettysburg, with a small ball tucked away in the bottom, and in a wooden jewelry box, a copy of the book Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. In the hand of Chamberlain's daughter, the letter read, February 12, 1914.
Dear Doug, please accept these gifts as a token of my esteem for you and your father. The afternoon that we spent at Gettysburg was most splendid. I send you these two gifts, both of which have meant so much to me over these many years, to help you understand some of the ways of the world at your young age. You may have read the magnificent work by Mrs. Stowe. If you have not, I commend its reading at your earliest convenience. You will note the message inside the front cover. Mrs. Stowe was the wife of one of my professors at Bowdoin. The Stowes would frequently entertain students in their home on Saturday evenings for scholarly discussion and readings. I was fortunate to have been included in those gatherings. She was a most brilliant, devout, passionate, and compassionate woman. Doug quickly opened the front cover and saw the message. Lawrence, what a delight to get to know you during this unforgettable year. My gratitude for your warm reception of this story. May the good Lord find a way to make use of your unbounded intellect, spirit, and character in easing the plight of these desperate people. Congratulations on your commencement from Bowdoin College. Godspeed. Harriet Beecher Stowe, June 12, 1852. Doug marveled at the book, not realizing the significance of a 60-year-old signed first edition. He would read it in short order, he told himself. He continued on with the letter. The stick I send as well, mostly because it represents so much that is good in man, even at the worst of times. As I told you last year, this stick was presented to me at the field hospital behind the Union lines at Gettysburg. I shall not dwell on my own actions during the fray, nor will I subject my daughter to recording the incident. I can speak to the stick itself, however. Since the stick was presented to me as an act of kindness between two combatants, I have held it in the highest regard for the last 50 years. It is sufficient to say that the Confederate officer, Colonel Casey, asked me to pass the stick along to a worthy young man of my choosing in the name of honor and compassion. I believe you will find the stick will aid you in learning about the proud people whence it came. I trust that you will treat this gift with the respect it has earned over the last 100-plus years. At a place and time of your choosing, please pass it along to another worthy young man. May God bless you. J.L. Chamberlain. Robbie looked in amazement at Chamberlain's pained signature. He turned to Red Hawk. So that's how the stick and book were passed down? Yes, a pretty remarkable story, isn't it? Robbie shared the details of his dream with his parents, who asked him to record it in his journal.